Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
I'm Katia Adler from the Global Story podcast. Today we're looking at Sudan and the brutal conflict raging there. We hear from some of the millions of civilians brutalised and displaced. It's been dubbed the Forgotten War. But is it more ignored than forgotten by the international community? And if so, why? Find us wherever you get your podcast.
Hello, welcome to NewsHour. It's coming to you live from the BBC World Service studios in central London. I'm Tim Franks. And we're beginning in the Middle East with a question which may sound a bit academic, but the question is whether we are on the cusp of another major conflict or whether that major conflict is already inexorably, unstoppably underway. Today, the Israeli military said that it had hit 300 Hezbollah targets in southern Lebanon. That would be the biggest wave of airstrikes since this latest round of hostilities began last October. The Lebanese Health Ministry has just said that more than 180 people have been killed in those attacks and more than 700 injured. The country's information minister, Ziad Makari, had this warning.
The continued Israeli aggression on Lebanon is a war of extermination in every sense of the word and a destructive plan that aims to destroy Lebanese villages, towns, and eliminate all green spaces. In all the contacts we make, we call on the United Nations, the Security Council, and the influential countries to stand with the truth and deter aggression. We renew our commitment to the UN Resolution 1701 in full, and we are working as a government to stop the new Israeli war and avoid as much as possible falling into the unknown.
The Israel Defense Forces had earlier announced that it had sent messages over the Lebanese mobile phone network telling residents in the south to move away from Hezbollah staging or storage posts. This is what the IDF spokesman Daniel Hagari had to say about that evacuation order.
We advise civilians from Lebanese villages located in and next to buildings and areas used by Hezbollah for military purpose, such as those used to store weapons, to immediately move out of harm's way for their own safety.
Hezbollah has in turn launched missiles at several targets inside northern Israel today. Let's begin with our correspondent in Beirut, Ugo Beshega. Ugo, obviously these airstrikes already today have caused significant damage, significant casualties, but these major evacuation orders, what's your sense of how far people are trying to comply with them?
Well, we've seen images of long traffic jams of people trying to leave southern parts of Lebanon to come here to Beirut, including the city of Tyre, which is one of the largest cities in Lebanon. And now, just moments ago, the Interior Ministry here in Lebanon announced that schools here in Beirut, also in Tripoli, are going to be turned into shelters for those residents who've been displaced by these attacks. I mean, we're talking about the deadliest day in Lebanon since the beginning of this conflict. These are the most intense, widespread airstrikes by Israel, not only southern Lebanon, where, Hezbollah is located, but also in the eastern Bekaa Valley, which is another stronghold, Hezbollah stronghold here in Lebanon. But for the first time, the north of the country has been hit. So I think in some parts of Beirut, even there is panic, because many believe that more attacks are likely to come and that even the city itself, especially Dahiya, which is Hezbollah's stronghold in the southern suburbs of Beirut, could be one of the targets of this expanded Israeli offensive against Hezbollah.
And I guess one of the things about the situation in Lebanon, Ugo, is that, I mean, all over the world, civilians who are caught up in war feel terror and a lack of agency. But it feels as if, I mean, you tell me you're there, but it does feel as if, strangely in this, one of the actors without much agency is the Lebanese government itself, because Hezbollah doesn't necessarily answer to the Lebanese government.
Exactly. I mean, it's a very difficult situation for the Lebanese government because they don't have a lot of influence, if any, over the actions by Hezbollah. This is a group that acts as a state within the state. It has its own strategy, goals, priorities. It says that these attacks are, a show of support for Palestinians in Gaza, and that these attacks are going to continue. And since those attacks started last year, a lot of people here in Lebanon have been concerned that, with these attacks, Hezbollah was dragging Lebanon into a conflict with Israel that is not in the country's interest. I mean, this country has suffered so much in recent years, a huge economic crisis, the port explosion here in Beirut. Many people still remember what happened in 2006 when, there was a war between Hezbollah and Israel. And many here fear that history might be repeating itself.
Ugo Bashega in Beirut, thank you very much. Let's head to our correspondent in Jerusalem, Daniel DeSimone. Daniel, in terms of what the Israeli war aims are, how intense this new wave of strikes could be, what are the signals that you are picking up?
Well, the Israeli leadership last week announced its war goal relating to the north of the country and relating to Hezbollah. And that is to return home 60,000 Israelis who've been displaced in the north of the country due to rocket fire from Hezbollah over the past year. And since then, we've obviously seen a wave of attacks targeting Hezbollah. Airstrikes last week, which were extensive, but not as extensive as today. And then we also saw the walkie-talkie and pager attacks. But the Israeli military has come out today and said it's going to achieve this goal. There's been briefing from senior military officials saying that in order to do that, they need to stop the rocket fire. They need to dismantle the infrastructure that Hezbollah has built up, and it's a pretty unambiguous goal that they've set. But it's not been met because Hezbollah is still firing rockets. So that does leave the question about how much further are they going to go. They're saying today that in terms of the targets they're striking, they're saying that Hezbollah is hiding weapons within civilian infrastructure, as the Israeli military put it, and that is why it's targeting the places it's targeting. It provided a warning this morning to civilians in the south of the country, saying if they live in or near properties that are used to house weapons, they should leave. They've also provided a similar warning to people who live in the Bekaa Valley. But of course, for people who live in, that covers swathes of Lebanon, and for people who live in those vast areas of Lebanon, there was no clarity about whether their particular towns or villages would be targeted or where they should go.
And on the Israeli side of the border, is there any evidence of ground troops mustering to a point where they may stage an incursion anytime soon?
No, there isn't any evidence of that yet. I mean, last week, the Israeli army moved a division up from the south, who had been they'd been concentrating on Gaza, to the north. So that meant there's now two divisions in the north. It significantly increased the number of troops in the north. The Israeli military hasn't ruled out a ground incursion, but they said the briefing this morning was that isn't currently the focus. The focus is currently on an air campaign. But it certainly can't be ruled out, I think, because they've set this goal for themselves. They've said they're going to destroy and dismantle Hezbollah infrastructure. And there is a question about whether that can be solely achieved via airstrikes.
Daniel DeSimone in Jerusalem, thank you very much. Let's return now to Beirut or just southeast of the Lebanese capital, Beirut, the city of Shouf. That's where Michael Young is, senior editor of the research group, the Carnegie Middle East Center. Michael, thanks for your time. I don't know if you heard my question at the top of the program, and I don't know what you make of it, but what is your sense as to whether, what we've seen today does basically mean we are now embroiled in a full-scale conflict between Hezbollah and Israel, or whether you still think that we're sort of on the cusp, there is a moment here where perhaps the two sides could pull back?
Well, I mean, we're obviously today in a major confrontation. The thing is, I think we have to understand a little bit what's going on. There is essentially a game of deterrence that has been played by Hezbollah and the Israelis for almost the past year, since the 8th of October last year. In other words, when the Israelis escalate, Hezbollah escalates, or when Hezbollah escalates, the Israelis escalate. And they've played this game, you know, each side plays this game to ensure that the other doesn't have a decisive advantage. Well, what happened last week is that in recent weeks, of course, the Israelis have redeployed troops away from Gaza towards their northern border. It was clear when that would happen that the Israelis were going to escalate to a much higher level than previously. And effectively, what they did with the attack last week, the attacks with the pagers and the walkie-talkies, and then on Friday, the assassination of a senior Hezbollah military commander, as well as several commanders of the Radwan force, is that they notched it up. They racked up, they raised the level of escalation. Yesterday, Hezbollah had to respond to this. And what they did yesterday is that they bombed extensively northern Israel to try to create essentially a displacement of population. So what we're seeing today is the Israelis coming back towards Hezbollah and saying, if you are trying to displace our population in the north, then what we're going to do is displace your population from the south, you see. And so it's this game of deterrence on either side that in a way doesn't really have a limit to it at some point. But we're short of a full-scale war, by which I mean each side targeting the infrastructure and the major cities of the other. But yesterday, Hezbollah was careful not to bomb Haifa, it bombed near Haifa.
Understood. I guess my question, though, is just whether, given that this game, as you put it, of escalation and deterrence isn't working at the moment because we're still on that ratchet, whether there is anything that can now be done to try and pull the two sides back. I mean, it would be a disaster for the Biden administration if there were an all-out war, and yet Israel doesn't seem to be listening.
Well, I mean, I don't think the Biden administration is listening either. I mean, it's been clear for months that the only way the Americans could, you know, lower the temperature in Lebanon was to impose a ceasefire in Gaza, which they haven't done. So, I mean, no, but your point is well taken. Of course, we're in a cycle now that it's going to be very difficult to bring under control unless one of the parties basically makes a concession. And the weaker party is, in this case, Hezbollah. When I say weaker, it's relative. Hezbollah is not weaker because it doesn't have the weaponry. It's weaker because Hezbollah doesn't have the latitude, does not want to provoke a major all-out war in Lebanon, which would be disastrous for the party and its standing within the country. So in a way, Hezbollah is fighting with one arm behind its back. And the Israelis know this, which is why they are ratcheting up the pressure, because they know very well that Hezbollah cannot do the same. They cannot escalate to the same levels as Israel. And therefore, we're in this sort of perverse game of deterrence in which Hezbollah cannot escalate as high as the Israelis can, but at the same time refuses to make any concessions. Okay. And therefore, we are in an open-ended fight until somebody bends.
Michael Young, senior editor at the Carnegie Middle East Center, joining us from Shouf to the south of Beirut. Thank you very much for joining us here on NewsHour. This is NewsHour, live from the BBC World Service with me, Tim Franks. In the US, one big question is doing the rounds on social media among the Latino diaspora community. Is Kamala Harris really a communist? Well, previously she has shown support for some policies which could be described as leftist, like government-funded healthcare for all. That is still some distance from what most people would understand as communism. But social media watchers say that the tactic has capitalized on a real fear among some Latino communities who have fled places like Cuba or Venezuela. From the US, here's our correspondent, Ione Wells.
This is a video appearing to show Kamala Harris and her running mate Tim Walz posing for a selfie in front of a Revolutionary Communists of America sign. It's been viewed hundreds of thousands of times. But there's a catch. It's fake. the background doctored by a group of Donald Trump supporters.
Una sede de socialistas.
That didn't stop the message spreading widely in Spanish-speaking media in South Florida, which has a large Cuban and Venezuelan diaspora.
That I live in South Florida, right, where I turn on the radio station and or I look at social media or I can look at different things and you go to a restaurant and you hear it. You know, it's just like it's everywhere where you go. It's like this doubt, right? Is this person a communist?
Evelyn Perez Verdía is a cultural context strategist. She was listening to the Spanish language radio station La Nueva Poderosa in Miami when she heard the hosts discussing the doctored video.
And they started saying, did you see how blatant they were?
She asked the station to debunk what she realized was fake news. The host corrected themselves on air, but said it didn't detract from Kamala Harris being a Marxist. She criticized the Democrat campaign for not doing enough to address these communities' fears, allowing them to be exploited by misinformation.
Don't laugh off people's fears. You know, the people have genuine fears. They come to the United States. They leave everything behind. And if they have a doubt, you should address their doubts.
We'll end up being Venezuela on steroids.
The Digital Democracy Institute of the Americas monitors thousands of Spanish WhatsApp and Telegram channels. It says there was a spike in Spanish messages linking Harris to communism after the presidential debate.
She's a Marxist.
To Marxista, Spanish for Marxist, trended on social media, and searches for Marxist on Google rose by 1,000% in the U.S.
And this information is caused a lot of, you know, a lot of damage within the Latino community and specifically in the Venezuelan community.
Samantha Barrios is Venezuelan-American and votes Democrat. She feels she recently lost a friend over very tense interactions about what she described as misinformation targeting Venezuelan voters.
Our relationship has deteriorated because of it. When we meet with family members, it's just a constant struggle to try to either avoid the situation.
For some voters from these diasporas, their criticism of the Democrats is grounded in very real fears or opinions. The US government has not provided a tough enough response to governments in Cuba or Venezuela. But she says this is weaponized through false claims Kamala Harris herself is a communist. These include AI images of Kamala Harris portrayed in communist uniforms, shared by Donald Trump and Elon Musk, with tens of millions of views.
And when we listen to this kind of rhetoric,
Harris's campaign say she is a capitalist and she has not advocated communist policies such as the abolition of private property. But for some voters, their fear lies in anything they feel could even remotely resemble the left because of what they associate this with in countries they came from.
She is woke.
Duke Machado runs a Republican Latino Facebook page in Texas.
They're not going to come here and just say, you know what, tomorrow we're going to be a socialist country, but they can come in and take over our education system. They can come in and take over our medical system. And before you know it, we've been converted.
I asked if he really believed Kamala Harris was a communist or if it was responsible to claim this to voters who may have fled repression.
I'm not going to say that she is a communist because I don't have any validation on that. But here we know that socialism leads to communism. I see it as a duty. I don't get paid to do this. And they're not even trying to hide it anymore. It's not irresponsible at all.
Trump or Harris?
Latino voters will be key in this election. There are about 36 million eligible voters. It's high percentages in swing states like Nevada and Arizona. Latino voters are by no means homogenous. While they've tended to favour the Democrats, polls show Republicans have gained ground in recent years. Factors include the economy, immigration and abortion rights. Messaging about socialism and communism in communities with large Cuban and Venezuelan diasporas, like Florida, is just one.
Ione Wells reporting from the US. The former British Defence Secretary, Ben Wallace, has been appearing today before a judge-led independent inquiry that he set up to investigate allegations that British Special Forces, the SAS, executed detainees in Afghanistan. Mr. Wallace has been answering questions as to whether he approved changes to a draft bill which would have reduced the time limit for prosecuting troops serving overseas, reducing it from 10 years to 5 and thereby excluding those caught up in the SAS allegations from Afghanistan. Divya Talwar is one of the BBC's investigative reporters. She's been following today's proceedings at the Royal Courts of Justice in London. What are the questions from Mr. Wallace?
Well, this is Sir Ben Wallace's first time giving evidence to the inquiry, which he actually commissioned back in December 2022 when he was the Defence Secretary. And let's just remind ourselves of the key task of this inquiry. It's to look into serious allegations against UK Special Forces in Afghanistan, because it's alleged that they unlawfully killed civilians and unarmed detainees between 2010 and 2013 during night raids. Now, the questions that Sir Ben Wallace is facing is about changes to a draft bill that would have helped protect UK Special Forces from prosecution. Senior government sources have told BBC Panorama that Mr. Wallace personally approved changes to the bill that would reduce the time limit for prosecution of UK forces serving overseas from 10 years to 5 years. And the reason why that's significant is that because it would mean that UK forces accused of these war crimes in Afghanistan during that time period would be exempt from prosecution under normal circumstances. There's two questions for Mr. Wallace. That is, was he aware of the alleged war crimes when he presented the bill to Parliament? And was he aware of serious concerns of investigations into those alleged war crimes? So today's public hearing, and possibly tomorrow, Sir Ben is facing questions about what he knew and when, essentially.
And Ben Wallace himself has been very critical on social media about the BBC's investigations. Do we know what he has had to say at the inquiry today?
Well, before the inquiry, the BBC did ask him to respond to the questions, and he said that it would be wholly inappropriate and disrespectful to answer questions before he had the chance to give evidence. And like you said, he has taken to social media. On Friday, in fact, he posted saying that the BBC's questions were leading and inaccurate. But former colleagues and senior military figures close to him have said that he does have serious questions to answer. And today at the inquiry, we heard that his time as Defence Secretary, his role that he held for 4 years, is really key to the inquiry. And Sir Ben Wallace said today that he had set up the inquiry to get to the bottom of the allegations. And he said that that was hardly evidence of a cover-up on his part.
Divya Talwar, one of the BBC's investigative reporters, speaking to me from outside the Royal Courts of Justice in London. There's much more to come in the next 30 minutes here on NewsHour. We'll be hearing from Israel, including from a resident of a kibbutz very close to the border with Lebanon, on why she has decided to return despite the apparent danger. That's coming up here on the BBC World Service.
I'm Katia Adler from the Global Story podcast. Today we're looking at Sudan and the brutal conflict raging there. We hear from some of the millions of civilians brutalized and displaced. It's been dubbed the Forgotten War. But is it more ignored than forgotten by the international community? And if so, why? Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to NewsHour. September brings the wine harvest for major European wine producers, which this year have again seen their yields hard hit by a changing climate. While new wine regions are emerging with better growing conditions, for traditional wine regions, drought and rising temperatures are posing a challenge. Sophie Eastall has been investigating for the BBC's Climate Question podcast from Catalonia.
We are in Mas la Plana, a vineyard. So here we have very, very old vines.
Josep Sabarich is the chief winemaker at Familia Torres, one of the oldest family wine companies in Spain. The family has been making wine here since 1870, but now it's facing a huge challenge.
We have a big drought period, having half yield in the vineyards as an average in the area.
Wow. Yeah, so that's you had half as many grapes grown as a normal year.
Yes, because when the drought periods are too long, another thing appears that was unexpected in the area. I never seen that, is the death of the plants.
for the grapes that do survive, higher temperatures mean they ripen 2 weeks earlier, and that affects the taste and character of the wine.
The aromas are evolving from fresh or green fruit to ripe and then overripe and jammy fruits. You have more sugar in the grapes, so more sugar means more alcohol in the wines.
A recent study found that 90% of traditional wine regions in lowland Spain, Greece, Italy, and Southern California could disappear by the end of this century if they don't adapt. The Torres family have started planting grapes at altitude to get away from the scorching heat.
We have been producing grapes in the Pyrenees at 1,000 meters. If you go up, the temperatures are very low comparing to here, so that's good for the plants.
In a test vineyard, I saw one of their other strategies. Mireia Torres is part of the family's fifth generation of winemakers. Using announcements in the local press, she's been leading a grape hunt across the region.
Then we have Cerello, Bronza, Gonfals, Moneu, Solana, Querol.
Mireia's found 60 varieties so far, some of which are more resistant to drought and ripen later, which helps with higher temperatures. She hopes they'll be the climate-proof wines of the future.
And this is the Forcada. This is the white variety. It was an old lady that has several old vineyards, and we found more than one variety in these vineyards. So it was a very good day.
Finding the vine is just the start of a long 12-year process to get it checked for viruses and officially approved. As the world warms, you might start noticing more unfamiliar grape varieties on the market as places like Spain try to keep the wine flowing.
Sophie Eastall reporting from Catalonia. You're with NewsHour. It's live from the BBC World Service. I'm Tim Franks. Let's return to our top story, the intensifying conflict between Israel and the Hezbollah militia in southern Lebanon. Israel carrying out its biggest wave of airstrikes since Hezbollah started firing missiles into Israel last October in support of Hamas in the Gaza Strip. The IDF says that it hit 300 Hezbollah targets in southern Lebanon. The Lebanese government, shortly before we came on air, said that 182 people had been killed in the airstrikes, more than 700 injured. Let's get some Israeli perspectives now. Israel's ambassador to the UK, Tzipi Hotovely, spoke to the BBC about why Israel was so committed to striking southern Lebanon.
Since 8th of October, Israel is under massive attack from Hezbollah. We're talking about over 9,000 rockets being fired on our cities. And we are in a situation that I think no country in the world can tolerate, where cities in the north being evacuated, over 70,000 people lost their homes, being refugees in their own country. We're talking about a million Israelis under fire yesterday from Hezbollah's attacks. We're talking about long-range rockets that are being supplied to Hezbollah by Iran. This is the reality of this horrific terror organization that became a terror monster with military abilities. So Israel is not interested in another 7th of October, and it's our duty to bring the peace back to our northern cities. I think it's very simple.
Tzipi Hotovely, well, one of those tens of thousands who evacuated their home in northern Israel is Daniela Porat-Penso. She's from the kibbutz, the small community of Yiftach, just a kilometre or so from the Lebanese border. And a few months ago, she decided to return to the kibbutz, one of a handful to do so. What's it like there now?
It's very quiet, as in, you know, the kibbutz is, I mean, nobody's there except for me and some other maybe 10 or so civilians and our defense squad. You know, we hear the bombing in Lebanon, we hear the bombing in Israel, bomb drones flying over us, so we have alarms. But other than that, when there's nothing like that, it's very quiet and very tense.
When you say you hear drones overhead, these are drones that have what? Are flying out of southern Lebanon?
Yes, and, yes. And, there are a lot of them.
Yeah, and I mean, have you been targeted? Has the kibbutz been targeted?
I don't know if it's the main target, but when our defense detects them. Sometimes they're being shot in the air above us, and sometimes they just move on and being going to somewhere else. I don't know if we're the target. It's a small place.
Sure. And when the sirens go off saying that you may be under attack, how long have you got to get to a safe place?
Nothing. No time.
It's just drop everything and go.
Yes. I mean, and sometimes, you know, I'm in my kitchen and I hear the siren, and on my way to the safe room, I hear like an interception or something like that.
Right.
So there's no real time. I'm sad to say that I'm used to it.
Yeah. But given that you're just, I mean, a kilometer or two from the border.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Why have you decided to go back to your kibbutz?
I saw no good reason why not to. I mean, I was tired of being away from home. I was away from home 7 or 8 months. And I kept wondering about, you know, going from here to there. And I really missed my home. And I felt that I'm not afraid. I don't know. Maybe I'm unique in that, but I'm not afraid. And I don't have small children. I just have my dogs. And I'm only responsible for myself. And I have a car, so I can, you know, drive away whenever I need to. It's just a choice. It's a choice between two bad things. And that's what I decided.
And Daniela, I don't know how far you're willing to talk about this, but I have mm-hmm. spoken to other people who either still do live in the north of Israel or did live in the north of Israel and have been evacuated elsewhere. Mm-hmm. A decent number of them say they don't particularly want war with Hezbollah, but they do say we have to do something about this. We have to do something about the fact that so many people have been forced to flee their homes. And so if mm-hmm. there is a big operation against Hezbollah, so be it. I mean, can I ask what your thoughts are?
Basically, I don't believe in war. I don't believe in war. I don't believe that war stops war. I cannot tell you whether it's a good thing or it will be a good result if we have a war, a whole war with Hezbollah or not. I have no idea. I just have my view on life.
Yeah.
Mind you, I just want to add that we are in war already for 11 months. People say we have to have a war with Hezbollah. We have a war with Hezbollah. I feel it in my life. We have a war.
Tell me how long you've lived in Yiftach.
I've lived in Yiftach for 15 years or so, but I was born not far away from there in the Upper Galilee, and I've lived there all my life. I'm 58 years old.
Okay. You know, you have known war in the region. I mean, there've been...
Since 2006, we didn't have war.
Exactly. Well, since 2006, but then you go back to, you know, what happened in 2000, what happened during the 1980s. I mean...
Exactly.
It's... I just wonder whether you think this is just the latest round and it's just a sort of inevitability, or whether you think actually at some point there is any chance that this will stop.
I don't know. I'm not a prophet, but I completely agree with you that this is just another round. And it will, okay, so now we'll have a big war and we'll defeat them. And then, okay, so it will take. Well, I'm happy with 15 years with nothing. But I know that as it seems right now, I don't know, it doesn't seem to me that it's going to end soon. But I'm an optimist and I'm a peace seeker. So I have to keep my hope up.
Daniela Porat-Penso speaking to me from the kibbutz of Yiftach, right on the border with Lebanon in northern Israel. The Israel Defense Forces, the IDF, has made it clear today that it's only planning to expand its operations against Hezbollah, particularly in the south of Lebanon. Jacques Neria is a former colonel in the IDF. He's now a security analyst with the Jerusalem Center for Policy Affairs. What does he make of this intensification of Israeli strikes?
I think that Israel has had enough of the provocations of Hezbollah. The pressure exerted by the inhabitants, by the citizens who have left their homes on the 8th of October, this was the punch that pushed the government to act. Because, I mean, under this pressure and under the fact that Nasrallah was saying very clearly, I will not allow any Israeli citizens to go back to its home. So there was no other choice but to engage in a military confrontation with Hezbollah.
I guess the question now is where this will lead. And there are, as you will know, many voices inside Israel who say airstrikes is one thing, but the only thing that will ensure that Hezbollah is pushed back from its positions right on Israel's border is a ground invasion by Israeli troops.
I'm not. I don't agree with that view, at least right now. I think that the attacks that Hezbollah is just getting right now from the air force and from the artillery are quite enough in order to crush the positions and the fortification on the ground. And I believe that Hezbollah is waiting for a ground operation because he feels that this is the ground where he is superior. And he can impose deep casualties, great casualties on Israeli forces in the area, which is completely fortified with tunnels, with the fortifications, and with caches of weapons inside the civilian villages and homes. So this is the place where Hezbollah has promised there for Israel that this would be its hell.
And yet, if Israel does rely simply on airstrikes, I mean, there are those in Israel who say it is militarily not as effective.
My view is the following, that even if we get to the Litani, we will not secure security and peace for our localities on the border. Because, I mean, in an era where our enemy has missiles and has, long-range missiles, I mean, this would be, I mean, just postponing the issue. I mean, the issue is we have to defeat Hezbollah in order to reach a settlement, a political settlement, a diplomatic settlement. This is the essence of this campaign, in my view, because if we are going to go back to South Lebanon, we've stayed there for 18 years, and we know exactly that this is not the place to be. I mean, Lebanon is not, it's a swamp. And it will definitely drown us into a bath of blood there.
But except the counter argument from those who are perhaps more aggressive about a ground operation is they actually say, don't go back to that Israeli occupation from 1982. Look at what happened in 2006. That was a war that lasted, what, about 34 days?
Yeah,
who
won this war?
You got UN Security Council Resolution 1701 that said that, that Hezbollah should go back north of the Litani River and bought 18 years of relative peace.
We have to seek a political settlement with guarantees different than the one that we got with the 1701 Security Council resolution. This is clear. I mean, there is no military solution right now that would provide total guarantee of security for the northern border. Even if we just go back to the Litani River, by the way, the Litani River at a certain point is less than 10 kilometers from the Israeli border. So, I mean, on the one hand, you have 40 kilometers. On the other hand, you have 10 kilometers. So this is not the proper security zone to be created. And as I said, I mean, it is clear that Hezbollah will receive a blow. But the other blow would be if we are much more ingenious in this campaign, attacking and cutting the links between Lebanon and Syria and, crushing militarily Hezbollah or bring him to such a position where the Lebanese government will ask for a solution. And otherwise, I mean, there's no solution. There's no hope for nothing. I mean, if you claim all the time that boots on the ground, we've seen them with the Americans in Iraq. They won the campaign in weeks, and then, I mean, they suffered thousands of Marines who were killed. I mean, this is not what we want.
Do you think you are a minority voice among the military and political establishment in Israel?
I don't know. But certainly I'm one who says very clearly that I am against engaging right now in the boots on the ground. This would be a great mistake. And I don't know if the establishment is with me or against me. But I think that this is the right thing today to do.
Jacques Neria, former colonel in the IDF, now security analyst with the Jerusalem Center for Policy Affairs. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. This is NewsHour, live from the BBC with me, Tim Franks. Sometimes politics can be messy, elections can be messy. There are several countries in Europe where it can take a long time to form a government after inconclusive or fractured votes. Until now, that hasn't really been the case in France. But after the three-way split in July's parliamentary elections, it's only been today that the new right-leaning cabinet, chaired by the Prime Minister, Michel Barnier, met for the first time. France faces big problems, and this government is unlikely to get an easy ride. So what can we deduce from this ministerial lineup? Victor Goury-Lafont is the French politics reporter at Politico Europe.
The two main takeaways from the makeup of this new government, the first one is that it leans much more to the right than the previous administrations. We have a lot of cabinet members in key positions who are either members of the conservative party in France, which is called Les Républicains, or who are past members of that party who have since switched their allegiance over to Emmanuel Macron's side. But in any case, we can definitely see that this is a more conservative government in terms of policy, both on issues including immigration, crime, but also, you know, what you might call social or societal issues like gay marriage, more broadly LGBTQ plus rights. We can definitely see that there's something a little more right wing and conservative in the opinions and policy preferences of a lot of the cabinet members. The second big takeaway is that this is a government with a lot of people who are fairly new in politics, have limited experience, and a lot of the new ministers have never held government positions, even ministers who will be, you know, looking over important portfolios. I'm thinking of someone like Antoine Armand, who's the new finance and economy minister. You know, he's 33 years old, doesn't have necessarily a very lengthy political experience, but this is very much reflective of this new government, which has a lot of newcomers in its ranks.
Well, you say there are a lot of newcomers. I guess one of the more familiar figures is the new interior minister, Bruno Retailleau, and he's seen as a very strong character. Tell me about him.
Bruno Retailleau, he's been a senator for 20 years. He's been the leader of the conservative group in the Senate for 10 years. What he advocates for in terms of policy could definitely be, you know, characterized as hardline conservatism. He's very much opposed to immigration, and he's proposed very strong legislation on that, removing healthcare protection for undocumented foreigners. He has said that multiculturalism threatened the cohesion of French society. So he's definitely, you know, a much more conservative politician, you know, much more hard in terms of his right-wing politics than what came before him. And even then, you know, a lot of representative within the French president's camp. So he'll definitely be, you know, one of the characters who will kind of have to be looking out for.
And that was the French politics reporter at Politico Europe, Victor Goury-Lafont. That's it from this edition of NewsHour from me, Tim Franks, and the rest of the team here in London. Thanks for your company.
I'm Katia Adler from the Global Story podcast. Today we're looking at Sudan and the brutal conflict raging there. We hear from some of the millions of civilians brutalized and displaced. It's been dubbed the Forgotten War. But is it more ignored than forgotten by the international community? And if so, why? Find us wherever you get your podcasts.